Pittsburgh have all the fun.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you. Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT, the in sound from way out.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
WRCT, the in sound. from way out. RCT in sound from way out.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has sent troops into two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine shortly after recognizing them as independent states. The United Nations condemns the move. The Biden administration issued new sanctions, and Germany's moving to halt the approval of Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. We'll get the latest. Then we remember Dr. Paul Farmer, the pioneering public health icon. He died unexpectedly Monday at the age of 62. In Rwanda. He spent decades building community health networks, helping millions of poor people in Haiti, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, the U.S., and around the world.
And the system that we built up in the 80s, really confronting another disease, tuberculosis, relied very heavily on community health workers who we trained and, more to the point, we paid. You know, we thought, you know, do we expropriate the labor of the poor, or do we actually pay them? Like someone like I would get paid a fortune to do consulting and work like this. And we said, no. It's clear we have that they have to be our employees and co-workers.
We'll hear Dr. Paul Farmer in his own words and speak to one of his longtime colleagues at Partners in Health. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian troops have deployed to two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine after Russian President Vladimir Putin Monday declared them independent states. Putin made the announcement from the Kremlin during an hour-long speech in which he questioned the legitimacy of Ukraine as an independent sovereign state.
We demand from those who captured and hold the power in Kiev to immediately end the combat activities. Otherwise, all responsibility for the possible continuation of the bloodshed will be entirely on the conscience of the regime ruling the territory of Ukraine.
On Monday, the United Nations Secretary General condemned Putin's decision as a violation of Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty and inconsistent with the principles of the UN Charter. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, also criticized Putin's move during an emergency meeting of the Security Council Monday night.
He calls them peacekeepers. This is nonsense. We know what they really are. In doing so, he has put before the world a choice. We must meet the moment, and we must not look away. History tells us that looking the other way in the face of such hostility will be a far more costly path.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of violating the Minsk agreement and undermining diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict in eastern Ukraine. On Monday, the Biden administration issued limited new sanctions targeting investors in the Russian-backed separatist regions. Meanwhile, Germany has announced it's halting the permitting process of Russia's massive Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. We'll have more on tensions over Ukraine with Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of the Soviet Premier Khrushchev, after headlines. In Florida, a state Senate committee has passed a Republican-led bill that would ban almost all abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The legislation now heads to the full Florida Senate for a vote. The bill makes no exceptions for pregnancies that result from rape or incest and would require two physicians to certify an abortion is necessary to save the pregnant person's life. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has called the bill reasonable and supportive of protecting life. He's expected to sign the legislation if it reaches his desk. In an historic victory for reproductive rights, Colombia has legalized abortion during the first 24 weeks of pregnancy. Abortion rights advocates gathered outside the Colombian Constitutional Court in the capital, Bogota, Monday evening, celebrating as the decision was delivered.
This is a big achievement. With today's decision, all women won. We want a greater recognition of our full citizenship, more security over our bodies, and over our sexual and reproductive rights.
The Dominican Republic has begun construction of a wall along its border with Haiti. The nearly 13-foot barrier will cover about half of the 244-mile Dominican-Haitian border. Other border enforcement infrastructure will include fiber optics, movement sensors, cameras, radar, drones, and over 70 watchtowers. The wall's construction comes as Haitian migrants continue to flee extreme poverty, political instability, and violence. Dominican President Luis Abinader spoke at a groundbreaking ceremony Sunday.
The construction of this intelligent border fence will help protect our nation, safeguard the interests of our country, respect our dignity, our freedom, and defend our sovereignty.
Dr. Paul Farmer, the world-renowned infectious disease doctor and medical anthropologist, died unexpectedly Monday at the age of 62 in Rwanda on the grounds of a hospital and university he helped establish. As a medical student in 1987, Paul Farmer co-founded the group Partners in Health to deliver free, quality health care to people in Haiti. Over time, the organization grew into a national network serving patients in many of the poorest parts of the world and dealing with crises from AIDS to Ebola to tuberculosis. Later in the broadcast, we'll look back at our interviews with Dr. Paul Farmer over the years and speak with one of his closest colleagues at Partners for Health. Mali's parliament has approved a plan that will allow the West African nation's military rulers to remain in power for at least five more years. All but one member of Mali's 121-seat army-dominated legislature approved of the plan Monday, which fails to set a date for future elections. Mali's military had initially promised elections would be held this month after it seized power in an August 2020 coup. A German whistleblower has leaked data on 18,000 accounts showing Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse held hundreds of millions of dollars for dictators, human rights abusers, drug traffickers, arms traders, and others accused of serious crimes. Among those named in the massive data leak is Saad Khair, a former head of the Jordanian intelligence service and a key U.S. ally who participated in the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. Also exposed were former Egyptian spy chief Omar Suleiman, who's been linked to the widespread torture of political dissidents, as well as Ala and Gamal Mubarak, sons of former Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak. In Argentina, eight separate wildfires in northeastern Corrientes province have scorched nearly 2 million acres, destroying farms, pastures, and wildlife. The fires started last month, fueled by strong winds, low humidity, and searing heat and severe drought in a region that normally receives abundant rainfall. The Biden administration's paused the sale of oil and gas leases on public lands after a federal judge in Louisiana blocked the government from considering the cost of future damage from the climate crisis in its decision-making. Earlier this month, U.S. District Judge James Kane, a Trump appointee, barred federal agencies from using a higher value of the social cost of carbon, a metric that assigns a dollar value to each ton of greenhouse gases emitted. The Justice Department has promised to appeal the ruling, which is preventing at least four different agencies from finalizing at least 38 pending environmental rules. In Portland, Oregon, a 43-year-old man is under investigation for a Saturday night shooting that left one person dead and five others wounded at a protest against police killings. Witnesses say Benjamin Jeffrey Smith confronted Black Lives Matter demonstrators, calling them terrorists, before opening fire within 90 seconds of arriving on the scene. His bullets struck 60-year-old June Knightley in the head, killing her. Knightley was known as T-Rex to her friends and was a beloved fixture of Portland's LGBTQ+ community and racial justice protests. Four others were injured by Smith's handgun before someone returned fire and injured Smith, sending him to the hospital in critical condition. Portland's police have not said whether they will charge Smith with a crime. The police initially described the killing as a confrontation between an armed homeowner and armed protesters. And Long Island University has announced the 2021 George Polk Awards in Journalism. The award for national television reporting goes to American Insurrection, hosted by A.C. Thompson, directed by Rick Rowley. The Frontline PBS film documents how the Trump presidency has emboldened far-right movements across the U.S. Asmat Khan, Dave Phillips, and Eric Schmidt of The New York Times won for their investigations that uncovered intelligence failures and civilian deaths in U.S. airstrikes in the Middle East and Afghanistan. Also winning a Polk Award is Ian Urbina of The New Yorker magazine for his investigative report, The Secretive Prisons That Keep Migrants Out of Europe. Urbina tells the story of Aliu Kande, a 28-year-old father of three who fled his failing farm in Guinea-Bissau trying to reach Europe by boat from Libya. He was captured at sea by the European Union-backed Libyan Coast Guard and jailed at a notorious migrant prison known as Al-Mabani. Democracy Now! Recently spoke with Ian Urbina about his reporting.
Western and non-Western aid groups that are able to get into these facilities, Al-Mabani included, what's routinely documented is extortion, rape, torture, and sometimes murder. What we were investigating in particular was a particularly egregious murder in which guards opened fire on migrants, and Aliu Kande, our main character, was killed.
You can link to our interviews with Polk Award-winning journalists Ian Urbina, Asmat Khan, Rick Rowley, and A.C. Thompson at our website, democracynow.org, and watch all the interviews and see the transcripts. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, Russian President Vladimir Putin has sent troops to two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine after recognizing them as independent states. We'll speak with the great-granddaughter of Soviet Premier Khrushchev, Nina Khrushcheva, in a moment.
Да, я Крым посиле гей. Да волею го за храмали. Ще чумак заслав.
Chumak by the Ukrainian folk quartet Dakabraka. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin has sent troops into two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine shortly after recognizing them as independent states. Putin made the announcement Monday during a speech where he questioned the legitimacy of Ukraine as a state.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
The two Russian-backed regions had broken away from Ukraine in 2014, leading to a conflict that has left 14,000 people dead. While Russia supported the separatists 8 years ago, Moscow did not recognize the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic as independent states until Monday. In recent days, the Ukrainian government and Russian-backed separatists in the region have accused each other of violating a ceasefire agreement. On Monday, a spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General condemned Putin's decision.
The Secretary General considers the decision of the Russian Federation to be a violation of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine and inconsistent with the principles of the Charter of the United Nations.
During an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council last night, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield also criticized Putin's move.
Russia's clear attack on Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity is unprovoked. It is an attack on Ukraine's status as a UN member state. It violates a basic principle of international law, and it defies our charter. What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine. The consequences of this action will be felt far beyond Ukraine's borders.
Russia's UN ambassador claimed Russia was forced to take action in the Donbas region.
We remain open to diplomacy, for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbas is something we do not intend to do. Unfortunately, we are forced to note the extremely negative role played in all of this by our Western colleagues led by the United States. Instead of forcing Kyiv to implement its obligations, they have merely been openly egging Ukraine on, repeating the meaningless mantra that the obligations under the Minsk Agreement are not being implemented by Russia, which, as we've repeatedly underscored, is not even a party to the Minsk Agreements.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of violating the Minsk Agreement and undermining diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict in eastern Ukraine. On Monday, the Biden administration issued limited new sanctions targeting investors in the Russian-backed separatist regions. More sanctions are expected to be announced today. Meanwhile, Germany's announced it's halting the permitting process of Russia's massive Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. The big question now, what will Putin do next? Russia has as many as 190,000 troops near the Ukrainian border. Meanwhile, the United States has sent troops to Eastern Europe, while the U.S. and other NATO allies have increased arms shipments to Ukraine in recent weeks. We're joined now by Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. Also the book, The Lost Khrushchev, Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. She's the great-granddaughter of the former Soviet premier, Nikita Khrushchev. Her latest piece for Project Syndicate is headlined, Putin is No Nixon. Professor Khrushcheva, welcome back to Democracy Now! We spoke to you just over a month ago. You were in Moscow at the time. Can you first just respond to the latest developments, the significance of Putin's hour-long address yesterday and declaring the separatist areas of Ukraine independent states?
Thank you, Emmy. A lot has changed in a month. Or not much has changed in some way, because we're still waiting for the big invasion. I want to correct, not even correct, but sort of amend a little bit the statements about the Russian troops going into, or peacekeepers going into Donbas and Luhansk. It actually hasn't happened yet. And in fact, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said very prominently that they're holding on this decision. And the separatist leaders said that it's their decision when they're going to ask for peacekeeping. So in some ways, it does look today that the decision was made to recognize the republics as independent states. But Putin at this point stops here and could be a sign of he is slightly blinking and waiting for the further developments on the Ukrainian side, on the Russian side, to move forward. So this is something that I find, especially in studying criminology, is very important. These little words and steps that are being made and said. Yesterday's speech was remarkable in many kind of revisionist versions of history, and what was clear in the speech, in all the rhetoric that was being put forward, is that the addressee of this speech were not Ukrainians, were not even Russians. It was the United States. Is that that's how we see our situation. And we are looking at Ukraine as your, as he said, your client state. And you deal with your client state so it wouldn't be riling the Russian bear. He didn't, of course, say these words, but basically it was all about do not further rile the Russian bear, because if we recognize, I mean, we have recognized, and it seems to me that that's where we're willing to stop for now, but it does depend on your kind of diplomacy, your kind of political decisions, and so on and so forth. The rhetoric was tremendous. It was the knife at the Russian throat that Russia was a victim of giant Russia, 11 time zones that you mentioned in my book. The giant Russia was a victim of Ukraine manipulation. Ukraine didn't exist, only exists only because Vladimir Lenin made it so, because otherwise it would have been much smaller, because it was much smaller supposedly in the times of the Russian Empire. So if you wanted to commonize Ukrainians, we can show you how to you do it. So they were all these threats that can be metaphorical, but also can turn into something much more than metaphorical and become military. So what I know from Moscow and friends in Kyiv, I mean, everybody is on, and in Europe, everybody is on edge and do look for further statements or further actions of Putin. But once again, as we when we spoke a month ago, I still don't see the big invasion. I can be completely wrong. I will be washing my mouth with soap tomorrow. But so far, I think that that's what Putin's message to the West is that I made my point to all this giant rhetoric that I'm going to go to Kyiv. I have to be, I have to sort of show my military or my my firm prowess. But at this point, we're still not where the Joe Biden says we are. That is, in the next few days or next few weeks, Putin is ready to go to Kyiv.
Professor, I wanted to ask you, I listened to Putin's speech, at least the translation on C-SPAN, and it seemed to me that he was attempting, as you say, a revisionist history, but he was also raising significant criticisms. He basically blamed Lenin for creating this idea that republics of the Soviet Union had the right of self-determination to secede, and that somehow that Stalin had a much more controlled orientation toward the creation of the Soviet Union. But I'm wondering, in terms of the your great-grandfather, for decades, was the leader of the Communist Party in Ukraine. And in fact, it was under Khrushchev that the Soviet Union turned over Crimea to Ukraine. Isn't there some truth to the fact that during the Soviet period, more territory was added to what is currently the state of Ukraine? Clearly, the Ukrainian people have always existed, but there was a period where Ukraine grew as a result of political decisions made after World War II and by the Soviet government to increase its size. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, thank you. Yes, it was. I mean, and Putin is not a fan of Lenin. We know that he doesn't like revolution, so he doesn't like the revolution of 1917. He always thinks that Russia under the Tsar is what's much grander and, you know, had more gold and more palaces. And we know he loves palaces under the Tsar. So that's a given. So it's always sort of this nasty comments towards Lenin as well. It's Ukrainians who don't like Lenin, but he's the one who gave you all of it. As far as Khrushchev, yes, Khrushchev was in love with Ukraine. I mean, he was a Russian born, but he spent a lot of years in Donbass. In fact, that now that self-proclaimed republic loved Ukraine. You had this wonderful song, Ukrainian song at the beginning of the program, and he would have cried because in the evening he would always like to listen to Ukrainian songs and actually sang them. So he was a great, great fan. It's a little bit of mythology that it is under him Crimea became Ukrainian and was transferred from Russia to Ukraine. It was 1954. He was the head of the Communist Party, but he was not the head of the state. He was not the head of the government. So there's no signature under any of this documents that transferred Crimea to the Russian Federation. It was a collective leadership at the time, it was called. So it was a mutual decision, of course, with his recommendation. He thought it would be proper for managerial purposes, but really it's much more, I mean, since he's a Putin villain in a sense, since Khrushchev denounced Stalin, as it is well known at the 20th Party Congress, in a secret speech in 1956, and therefore he sort of made is a villain for kind of one of those, along with Mikhail Gorbachev during Perestroika, is one of those reformist leaders who shed the Russian lands, while people like Stalin and now like Putin, they are putting them together. So I think that is something important to clarify. But regardless of how Russians feel about Crimea, for example, legally it is not, it was, Ukraine was an independent state, became an independent state in 1991. And so in international law, the Crimea obviously is Ukrainian territory, and so is Donetsk and Luhansk. But for now, I think Putin is willing to stop here.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, there was an interesting op-ed piece by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times today. Now, I'm usually not a fan of Thomas Friedman, but he did raise, he's one of the few American journalists who has raised in the commercial media, who has raised what he believes was the grave error of NATO to expand into the former Soviet republics in the 1990s. And he actually quotes in that column an interview he did back in 1998 with George Kennan, the longtime ambassador to Russia, and who was one of the architects of the containment policy. And he says from that interview in 1998 that Kennan told him, "I think this is the beginning of a new Cold War. I think the Russians will gradually react quite adversely, and it will affect their policies. I think it is a tragic mistake. There was no reason for this whatsoever. No one was threatening anybody else." That was George Kennan back in 1998 about NATO's expansion into the East, into Eastern Europe. I'm wondering, to what degree do you think that this Friedman piece is accurate about the roots of what we're seeing right now?
Well, thank you. I actually have my own George Kennan, so I don't need Thomas Friedman to know this, because I was George Kennan's last research assistant at Princeton, exactly when Friedman was writing that piece in 98. So I know this kind of point of view of George Kennan's firsthand, because we spoke about it endlessly many, many times, and what a mistake it is. And he was saying he knows the Russian psyche, and for now they're willing to kind of surrender to the United States and Western leadership or Western policies. But one of the things that he said, and he was absolutely right, I mean, his knowledge of Russian psychology was tremendous. And he said, you know, Russians never follow anybody. So it is a mistake to think that when they get stronger, they're just going to follow the United States and whatever United States does. Russians don't follow, and Americans need the followers. And so that's going to be a problem head on, and it will affect Russian policies that would consider it is a violation of their own messianic, because one of the things that America and Russia share, it's the messianic idea that we are benefiting the world. Russia, of course, with its kind of almost murderous equality of everything and the beautiful Russian soul that equates all the measures of men, in America with its messianic idea of how everybody should be equally comfortable. And so Kennan was very critical of this, and in fact explained that, you know, first Gorbachev was promised not to move an inch to the east. Then Yeltsin was promised not to move an inch to the east. Then Yeltsin was told that, well, we would have to probably move an inch, but it's not going to be in your lifetime. That's why when Olaf Scholz meeting with Putin said, well, but Ukraine and Georgia are not going to be admitted in NATO in your lifetime, Putin laughed at him and said, wait a minute, but that was already said before. I have history on my hands, because one of the reasons I think Putin is acting non-politically, because he's the gatherer of land. So in history, even if militantly, he would need to go in history like Stalin, blood or not, but somebody who doesn't let Russia to be put on its knees, like Khrushchev did, they see it, and especially like Gorbachev did in after the collapse of the Soviet Union in after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So Kennan was very predictive of that. And in fact, I think Spiegel magazine, the German magazine, just uncovered, just published a few documents where indeed it was discussed that it's not going to move, NATO is not going to move east. And you know, Russians are now, the official Russians are now citing it left and right, saying that, of course, we are allowed to act the way we act because, look, the West is so hypocritical, they cannot teach us how to behave.
Nina Khrushcheva, 50 years ago yesterday, Chinese leader Mao Zedong met Richard Nixon. Your latest piece is Putin is no Nixon. As we wrap up, if you could briefly comment on the Putin-China relationship, the Putin-Xi relationship, and how that bears on what's happening right now.
Well, I'm not a fan of Nixon, so that was a big thing for me to write. Soviet Union and China have been sort of the bulwark against the West together. And this relationship with Mao and, well, first with Stalin was very shaky. But then with Khrushchev, it completely fell apart. And now we've seen during the Olympics that just finished, Putin went to Beijing. He was posing with Xi. They signed all sorts of, or they've been signing all sorts of cooperative agreements. So it does seem that once again, we're reliving that formula of Russia and China against the menacing and hypocritical West. What I was writing about is that while in the Soviet Union was richer and kind of slightly or not slightly kept the upper hand. But now, of course, it is the Chinese who are calling the shots, and Putin is there to provide political interference for Xi Jinping. And I think Putin will lose in this relationship because China is not going to make up for all the losses that the upcoming sanctions will bring on to Russia.
We want to thank you for being with us. And of course, we'll continue to cover what is happening in the region. Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, the book Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones, great-granddaughter of the former Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev. And we'll link to your piece, Putin is No Nixon. When we come back, we spend the rest of the hour remembering Dr. Paul Farmer, the pioneering public health icon, has died unexpectedly at the age of 62 in Rwanda. We'll hear him in his own words and speak to one of his longtime colleagues. Stay with us. Arcade Fire. The Canadian band's been a big supporter of Partners in Health, having donated a portion of their ticket sales to the group for years. I was at Paul Farmer's 50th birthday party when Arcade Fire came out and played for the celebration. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we spend the rest of the hour remembering Dr. Paul Farmer. The world-renowned infectious disease doctor and medical anthropologist died unexpectedly Monday at the age of 62 in Rwanda on the grounds of a hospital and university he helped establish there. Paul Farmer was a professor at Harvard Medical School, co-founder of Partners in Health. As a medical student in 1987, he co-founded the group to deliver free, quality health care to people in Haiti. Over time, the group grew into an international network serving millions of patients in many of the poorest parts of the world. Dr. Farmer tirelessly fought for his patients to receive the same access to life-saving drugs as patients in wealthy countries. Dr. Paul Farmer once said, "The idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that is wrong with the world." Farmer's work helped change how healthcare was delivered throughout the world. Partners in Health CEO Sheila Davis said in a statement, quote, "Paul Farmer's loss is devastating, but his vision for the world will live on through Partners in Health. Paul taught all those around him the power of accompaniment, love for one another, and solidarity." Former President Bill Clinton said Monday, "Paul Farmer changed the way healthcare is delivered in the most impoverished places on earth. He saw every day as a new opportunity to teach, learn, give, and serve. It was impossible to spend any time with him and not feel the same," Clinton said. The writer Tracy Kidder wrote about Farmer's work in his 2003 book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. Paul Farmer appeared on Democracy Now! Numerous times over the last 20 years. Later in the show, we'll speak with one of his longtime colleagues at Partner in Health. But first, let's turn to Paul in his own words, speaking in 2008 on Democracy Now! About his early work in Haiti.
Well, you know, it was, for me, an epiphany to go 25 years ago to go to Haiti. And I was lucky enough to end up in a squatter settlement of peasants who'd lost their land to a hydroelectric dam. So the choices were very stark. You know, either health was a commodity that was bought and sold, or the people that I went there to serve as a naive but well-meaning young person were out of the picture. And so, you know, that began a lifelong fascination with rights, not just to the right to vote or other civil and political rights, but also the right to eat and the right to have access to health care.
Talk about how you decided on this place called Cange in central Haiti, how you found it, how you began to build the hospital system you have there.
As is often the case, and I try to encourage students, I teach students, so I tell them, look, you never know what's going to happen. And it was really a series of serendipitous accidents. I met a Haitian priest, and he was working in a nearby town, and he told me about this squatter settlement where people were living in lean-tos, and he was focused on education and said, look, you're going to be a doctor. Why don't you come and be part of this? And so that was 25 years ago. We started with a small group of young people my age going from village to village, asking people in their homes, so what is it you would see as an appropriate healthcare system? And some people kind of laughed at us, saying, well, what do you, you know, and a little bit archly, well, what do you think, you know? And they would usually say, though, a hospital. We want a hospital. And we had in mind, you know, a system of a small community health clinic and a system of satellite system. They wanted a hospital. They wanted a good hospital. A hospital, someone said to me in 1984, where if you have trouble having a baby, you could actually have someone save your life. I knew just what that meant, of course. And sure, you know, over the years, with a lot of help from people, mostly in Haiti, but in North America, we built a hospital. It's a big hospital now.
Primarily treating what?
Well, you know, we primarily do not treat infectious disease, although I think we have a reputation of taking on AIDS, TB, malaria. But we treat whatever comes in, a broken arm, obstructed labor, you know, the things that you see out in the rural countryside in Africa or Haiti. And but in the mid-90s, I must say, just shortly after we built the hospital in a very difficult time during a coup. Those were very hard years, 91 to 94. You were already involved in reporting on that. But we did get the hospital done. And in by the mid-90s, we once looked to see, okay, how many people in this hospital have AIDS or HIV infection? And it was up to 40% at one point. So we said at that time, I was going between Harvard and Haiti. I was being trained as an infectious disease specialist at Harvard, and, you know, it's right around the corner to Haiti. So I'd get off the plane on one side, and I'd be begging my American patients, you've got to take these pills, these, you know, AIDS cocktails, and I'd get off on the other side, and they'd be begging me for the same medicines. So we spent a couple of years saying there's got to be a way to deliver the same services to people living in Haiti. And, you know, it took a long time to get that support. We started in 1998, and we actually called it somewhat sassily the HIV Equity Program, because we knew it would be a fight for equity from the beginning, and we knew it would be a fight for basic rights as well.
And yet you say that in some places in Haiti, they're getting better health care than the United States.
Well, you know, I believe that's true. I mean, I know it's true. You know, it's not really an assertion. For chronic disease, and AIDS would be a good example, you need to take, and you know, diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes is another, you have to take a medicine every day, you know, whether that be an antiretroviral cocktail or insulin, you have to take it every day. And the system that we built up in the 80s, really confronting another disease, tuberculosis, relied very heavily on community health workers who we trained, and more to the point, we paid. You know, we thought, you know, do we expropriate the labor of the poor, or do we actually pay them? Like someone like I would get paid a fortune to do consulting and work like this. And we said, no, it's clear that they have to be our employees and coworkers. So it worked great. And it worked great for tuberculosis. It worked great for other chronic diseases. And when AIDS came along, what we did was to say, well, clearly we need to take the same system, which is free diagnosis and free care to the patient, because it's a public health problem, and they have a community health worker, you know, visiting them. And so what I see, and what, you know, in this city, for example, in New York, I'm told they're contemplating adopting this model. I hope it happens. What we did was to bring the Haiti model up to Boston, you know, and I got in a little bit of trouble with some of my colleagues there saying, well, all we're trying to do is raise Harvard levels of care up to Haiti levels, because the outcomes were much better because they weren't lost to follow-up. That's medical jargon. But, you know, in the United States, you get someone who's really sick with a chronic disease. Either of those two diseases I mentioned, for example, would be true. And then they're sent home, but they don't have the appropriate support in, as they say here, in the community. And so then they get sick again and go back to the emergency room. Maybe they don't have insurance. Maybe they don't speak English. Maybe they have housing insecurity. This is the United States. But like Haitians, they have social problems, and our medical system doesn't deal with those problems well. And so the care can be better in Rwanda and Haiti than what we're seeing here.
Before we get to the end of the broadcast, I want to come back here, because your analysis is not just a medical diagnosis, but it is an analysis of the healthcare system, and that's ultimately what you're challenging.
Well, my diagnosis of our healthcare system's problems is that it's very expensive to give bad medical care to poor people in a rich country. Very expensive to give bad medical care to poor people in a rich country. And I could give example after example from my own clinical experience working in you know, the best hospitals I've ever seen, you know, in the world. And when they're in the hospital, things go okay. But we do not have a good safety net. We don't have a good primary health care system. And to get into the hospital, the uninsured, 47 million people, maybe 50, they have to pass through an emergency room, waste time. You know, and things happen to them there that probably shouldn't, because their primary health care problem is they're in an emergency room. And then again, on top of that 47 million, probably just as many Americans are poorly insured and can be thrown into destitution by serious illness. So, you know, there's 100 million Americans who don't have health security. They don't know that a devastating illness could not wipe out their savings or make them lose their home. They may know that. I hope they do.
That was Dr. Paul Farmer speaking in 2008 on Democracy Now! He died unexpectedly Monday at the age of 62 in Rwanda, where he lived. Today, we're remembering his life and legacy as a pioneering public health icon who spent decades building community health networks and helping millions of people in Haiti, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and other countries, joined now by one of his longtime friends and colleagues, Dr. Joya Mukherjee, infectious disease specialist, chief medical officer for Partners in Health, where she worked with Dr. Paul Farmer for 23 years. She is also an associate professor of global health at Harvard Medical School. Joy, I want to just start off our deepest condolences to you and to the Partners in Health family. And of course, Paul's family extended well beyond that. I mean, his nuclear family, but to the world, which is who he considered his family. Can you talk more about how he died, what you understand happened on the hospital grounds in Rwanda, and then talk about his significance?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Amy, thank you and the whole Democracy Now! Staff for your coverage of the important issues that Paul cared about for such a long period of time and for all the condolences and wishes. And of course, we're gutted by this loss. And, you know, I can't really speak too much about how Paul died. We're trying to be respectful of the family, and he died peacefully. We know that. And you know, he did have some heart trouble, which we knew about. What it means to us, you know, is just a deep sorrow. I think a sorrow for the whole world. For people who didn't know the extraordinary man that he was, he combined a very fierce intellect with just an absolutely expansive heart and generosity and a real enthusiasm and joy for service and fellowship that was unparalleled. And at the same time, he had impossibly high standards. We all learned to live with that. High standards for medicine, that everyone should get a very first world care, that there is no first, second, and third world. High standards for dignity. All of the hospitals that Paul was part of constructing are beautiful, have gardens and fish ponds, and he felt that there shouldn't be squalor in healing, which is so often the case in poor communities, that the health centers and hospitals are just in deplorable condition. But, you know, what we're remembering today, and we will remember, is that the two things that Paul gave us were this enormous community of people that he brought to this large table that is now global health, social medicine, social justice, young people around the world who have joined this mission, wealthy contributors, incredibly dedicated hospital staff, cleaners, drivers, doctors, nurses. He gave us this great community, expansive community. And the second thing he gave us, and your clip really is testament to that, Amy, is he gave us a roadmap. He was prolific in writing and speaking, incredibly clear in the idea of equity and justice for everyone. And so I do feel grateful that we know what to do to honor his legacy, to love one another, to care for the sick, to fight for higher, fairer standards. And it's a very radical notion, but he's broken it down for us play by play, if you will. And I think we will honor that vision and that work by following that great roadmap.
And Dr. Mukherjee, could you talk to us a little bit about how you first met him and how you came to work with him? And also about mm-hmm. Partners in Health, which now has about 18,000 people around the world. And how did that grow to such an extent?
Yeah, well, I came to the work in the late 90s as a very frustrated AIDS activist and doctor, having seen what Paul saw, the miracle of antiretroviral therapy and the absolute disinterest from powerful people, from the development complex, to make that treatment available to the 95% of people who were living with AIDS in the rest of the world, the large majority in Africa. And just everyone said it was too hard, it was too too costly, racist things, like Africans can't tell time, just a ridiculous set of narratives that I had heard in my work in Africa before joining Partners in Health as a young doctor, over and over again. But it wasn't what I saw on the ground. I had incredibly intelligent friends whose lives had great meaning in their families and their communities. And so I met Paul because they were treating a handful of patients in Haiti with antiretroviral therapy that was donated from patients who were changing medicine, unexpired drugs. And you know, just saying at least we can do this. I didn't have the vision that Paul had, that this pragmatic solidarity, as he called it, could also be world-changing. Of course, now I do. And AIDS activists around the world, from ACT UP in New York to the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa to TASO in Uganda, they saw what we were doing in Haiti as a roadmap. And we started to join forces together to really call for this universal access to AIDS treatment, even though there was no universal access to healthcare at all. And so I met him in this way. I signed up, you know, because it was the only place, Haiti was one of the only places in the world that was offering treatment for free to the destitute sick. And so that was 23 years ago.
Dr. Mukherjee, I wanted to go to Paul in his own words. Dr. Paul Farmer worked, as you said, in Rwanda for many years. In 2013, he appeared on Democracy Now! And spoke about his work there.
Well, you know, the work in Rwanda has been very uplifting for Partners in Health, for me, for our partners from Harvard, in part because we made a bet almost 10 years ago that if we could, as a collective, take this model, I'll call it accompaniment, but I'm not just talking about community-based care. I'm talking about rebuild a system that has hospitals, clinics, and community-based care. If we could go to a place with great need in terms, especially maybe in terms of infectious pathologies like malaria, TB, HIV, which we know a lot about in our team, post-conflict setting, maybe one even written off as hopeless, but with a government committed to rolling out basic services in health and education to poor people in rural areas. If we could find all that, we would see something miraculous happen in the course of a decade. And we did. That's why we went to Rwanda. We went with the Clinton Foundation and other partners and worked with the Ministry of Health of Rwanda. And that, you know, it's been the most rewarding decade in my life as a doctor, just to see how the reversal of fortune, how quickly it could happen. Just to give you some numbers, the life expectancy in Rwanda has probably doubled over the last 10 years, and the declines in mortality, especially among children, women in childbirth, declines in mortality among those who already have tuberculosis, malaria, and AIDS, these are the steepest declines ever recorded in human history.
Explain exactly what you did.
Well, we worked with the Rwandans, as did many other people, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, we were, there are many other groups, but the key is working with the public sector. After all, eventually, if people have a right to health care, it will be the public sector and not non-governmental organizations or universities from the United States that will confer those rights. So we worked to build a system, and the system stretched, as I said, from community health workers to clinics where the majority of care is given. Those are run by nurses. To having in every district a hospital. Partners in Health ended up building or rebuilding 3 of the 30 district hospitals, and including even starting a cancer center, probably the first cancer center in rural Africa anywhere. But it all fit into a system, and the vertical, they're called vertical programs in public health, so an AIDS program or a family planning program, those are vertical programs. What the Rwandan government and authority said is, we want those vertical programs to strengthen our health system, our Rwandan national health system. And we did do that, and we were pushed to do that. And the result is, I think that's why that decline is more steeper in Rwanda than in other places, and why it's the only country in sub-Saharan Africa on track to meet all of the health-related Millennium Development Goals.
So that was Dr. Paul Farmer in 2013. I last interviewed him in the midst of the pandemic, December 2020, when his new book, Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, had just come out. We talked about the pandemic, how it was possible at the time for the United States to have nearly 20% of the world's infections and deaths while having less than 5% of the world's population. This was Paul's response.
Well, I mean, we are facing the consequences of decades and decades of underinvestment in public health and of centuries of misallocation of funds away from those who need that help most. And, you know, all the social pathologies of our nation come to the fore during epidemics, and during a pandemic like this one, we're going to be showing the rest of the world, warts and all, how we have shown the rest of the world how badly we can do. And now we have to rally, use new tools that are coming online, but address some of the older pathologies of our care delivery system and of our country. I think that's where we are right now.
That was Paul Farmer speaking about the pandemic just a couple of years ago. Dr. Mukherjee, he always referred to Partners in Health as the House of Yes. Yeah. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think we all know that poor people face so many barriers to having good health. I mean, starting with adequate housing, lack of sanitation, water, but then even getting to the hospitals being in deplorable conditions, not having access to modern medicine. So I think if we are to follow Paul's radical vision for health as a human right, which we will, the House of Yes means saying, yes, we can do this, and then figuring out how, and then designing a system that can do it for others. So, you know, I'll just talk briefly about one young man that, you know, came to an Ebola treatment unit in Sierra Leone with a giant cancer in his neck. And a normal response would be, no, we're treating Ebola here. Go somewhere else, but we know there's no somewhere else. So we said, yes, we will try to take care of you. And, you know, by hook or crook, through providing chemotherapy and waiting it out and transferring him to other places, he now, you know, has graduated from high school and is completely cured of his cancer. So, you know, that House of Yes is to say, you know, we are here to care for one another on this earth, and we're going to try to always say yes and try to figure it out.
And so where do you go from here, Dr. Mukherjee? What are the big projects of Partners in Health? And also, will there be a memorial service for Paul?
We are still waiting for details on the memorial service from his family. We're in very close touch with his wife, Didi, and his children, and we will be working on that together. Where we go to follow roadmap that Paul gave us. And I think, you know, he died in a place that he loved and adored, which was Rwanda, but particularly having spent time with medical students there and the new medical school that we've built, the University of Global Health Equity. We are starting a second University of Global Health Equity in Haiti. And I think we know that building this vanguard of social justice and human dignity and health around the world is what he wants next and continue to do, but expand the training and, inculcation of these important principles.
Well, Dr. Joya Mukherjee, we want to thank you for being with us. Again, our deepest condolences. Dr. Mukherjee is an infectious disease specialist, chief medical officer for Partners in Health, where she worked with Dr. Paul Farmer for 23 years. She's also an associate professor of global health at Harvard Medical School. To see all of our interviews with Paul Farmer, you can go to democracynow.org to read about him. Tracy Kidder's book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World, and the Netflix film, Bending the Arc. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Uncle bought my ticket and a shiny pocket knife, and shadow at my side.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT.